This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
This hour, we're digging deeper, as we always do, with one special guest. My special guest today is Martin Foley, the MP for Albert Park. Let's sort of delve into your life a little bit. Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in the Mornington Bush Nursing Hospital, as it then was. It still exists, but it's no longer Bush.
So. No, we've suburbanised yes. So much of the peninsula now. But what was it like in your early days when you were living down there?
It was semi-rural. In my street, which was, I suppose, then the ends of the suburbs, there were still paddocks and cows, and it was a small community, nowhere near as big as it is now. And, you know, the further you get away from it, the more idyllic it looks in retrospect.
Mm. Probably wasn't, though. A bit primitive, perhaps?
Yeah. Now, looking back, it was a very closed kind of community in a way. I think our most exotic neighbours were the Latvians, and that was about it. Other than that, it was very white. It was very middle class. It was very, in retrospect, insular kind of community that reflected an insular society, I think.
Mm. And how many children in your family?
Well, we're a good Catholic family, us Foleys. There were five of us, and all within about 8 years.
Uh-huh.
So there was an endless battle to get fed and make sure you were noticed.
Do you think it's different being in a bigger family to being in a small one or an only child? Do you think it makes you different?
I would imagine it would have to be.
I mean, the emphasis on sharing and having to make do,
yes,
and having to wait your turn and all
exactly.
that.
Exactly. I think that must have some effect.
Whereas spoiled brats like me, who didn't have a sibling until I was eight, you know.
Yes. Look, I think it would have to have an effect because, you know, family and early rearing have such an impact in whatever culture you're in. So I think it must have had an impact on me.
What were your parents like? What did your father do for a living?
He was a civil engineer, and that was sort of civil engineer land down there, surveying and doing whatever it is civil engineers do. All these years later, I'm still not exactly sure.
Build things, don't they?
Build things. And that was a kind of building things place. And he built things. And ultimately, because it was a little small firm, he worked his way up and ended up owning the firm and being the boss after sort of generational change in the place. So he was from a farming background himself, so he was relatively conservative. But you know, strong on family, strong on education, extremely strong on the value of education, and pretty smart cook in his own right.
And how about your mother?
She was from inner Melbourne. She was a nurse. Her family were railway people, and they weren't conservative. They were comms and old-style
Red
members
raggers.
Of the Communist Party. Her uncle was secretary of the Railways Union for many, many years, J.J. Brown. How they ever got together to this day, I don't understand. But,
well, they do say opposites attract, don't they?
Yes. And
because, I mean, you don't expect someone who's running a civil engineering business, building things, and running his own company to be taking up with a commie unionist daughter.
No, you don't. Or niece. But I think they met when they were students.
Yeah.
And he never finished his engineering degree. By the time he got married, he made her a promise later, before she died, that he'd finish his degree. So with five children on his own, down on the Mornington Peninsula, working full-time, he still managed to find time to go back and finish his degree and kicked on from there.
Because you lost your mother quite early, didn't you?
I did. Today is actually the 40th anniversary of her death. So I was 8 years old, and that was, you don't remember much from eight, but in retrospect, it was clearly a pretty big traumatic effect on our family.
Mm. But your father still managed to keep you all together and bring you all up, obviously.
He did. He's
so a strong man.
A very strong man. He had help from my nan, my mum's mum. She came down from Elwood, where I now live. I actually live in her old house. Funny the way these things go around. And together, they not only held the five of us together, actually they did pretty well. All of us got through tertiary education. Some have done postgraduate degrees. We're all still alive, so that's an achievement. And we're all relatively sane.
Was religion a big part of your upbringing?
Yes. This was a traditional working class, particularly on my mother's side, Catholic family. And it was very strong, particularly from my nan, but in a very pragmatic way. My nan was incredibly selective as to which parts of Catholicism she'd
isn't that true of most Catholics, I think?
Yes, I think so.
I mean, I've been reading an awful lot of things lately about the Pope's visit to the UK and all these surveys of English Catholics who said, well, basically we just ignore what the Church says and we do, you know, what we want.
Exactly. And I think that's a fair description of the sort of brand of Catholicism I was brought up with. But you get to the point in your life, you think, what is this? And you dispensed with it.
So you're not religious now?
No, I'm afraid me and the one true Holy Catholic Apostolic Church parted ways a very long time ago.
Was that when you went to uni?
No, it was before then. I remember a stand-up debate with my dad. I was going to join the Labor Party and not go to church anymore.
And, interesting that you bracket the two together. The Labor Party is a strong Catholic, a strongly Catholic party at that time, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed. And still has a bit of a tendency in that direction. But no, they were two very conscious decisions.
Yes, and we've actually just yesterday discovered we've got a remnant of the old Democratic Labor Party still marching on. They've got themselves a senator.
Yes, bizarre.
Let's go back a little bit again. You said in the notes that you gave me before this interview that you thought your grandmother in particular and her highly selective version of Catholicism, as it were, had given you a lot of values that you still hold on to today.
Yes.
And you mentioned in particular helping other people in need regardless of your own circumstances.
Yes.
Is that the kind of thing she did?
Sure was. Being a railway family, they never had much money to my recollection, but there was never a time when anyone was knocked back for anything, let alone the active participation she had in some strange groups. Now looking back on it, the Good Neighbour Society, I'm not exactly sure what the Good Neighbour Society would translate in, but actively going out and helping new migrants settle in, feeding them, showing them around, the St. Vincent de Paul Society, any number of issues that she was always involved with, and they always had an aspect of feeding people, in my recollection.
And that was kind of traditional female role at that time, wasn't it, I suppose? But it has a political edge to it too, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it sure does.
You also mentioned the power of doing things collectively rather than individually as being something else you got from her.
Definitely. On your own, you had very little chance of achieving much. It was community, it was union, it was school, it was any group was going to be more effective and more powerful than what you could do as an individual.
And you mentioned also education as the way out of poverty, a restricted background.
Yeah, she's a child of the Depression, and the effort that she went to work to put her kids through, my mum and others, through the Catholic education system. Saw my mum a nurse, her sister a social worker, her brother ended up doing his PhD in theology, ended up being a handyman, but just that whole
strange
whole
training for a handyman.
Yes, absolutely. but just the whole focus on the value of education, both in its own right, but as an empowering thing, but as a pathway out of hardship.
Yeah. It's still sounding very Billy Elliot, actually.
without any artistic flair whatsoever.
Without the artistic bits, yeah. That, of course, is always another way out, isn't it? Because you've got education, you've got sport, and you've got the arts. It's like the three ways out, the three ways up. You went into politics.
Yes. That's strange. The way things
happen. Because you're not from a political family.
No.
So, Was it the experience of seeing union organisation and what that could achieve that moved you into politics, do you think?
I joined the Labor Party before I got into being a union official. I think it was just the value of what you could do on your own versus what you could do as part of a broader group. And I joined when I was 18, indeed before I went to university, but the university experience and the opportunity to get involved in a range of different activities, of which politics was one, was what really drove me down that path of the importance of good policy, good activities, and the opportunities that it can bring.
What was uni like at that time?
Oh, it was fantastic. They paid you to go to university in those days.
I know.
It was wonderful. I could kick a football in those days, and that was fantastic. And the world opened up, whether it was the arts, because I was an arts student, the opportunity just to indulge anything you liked. It was just liberating in the extreme. It was, again, the further away you get from it, such an important and great time in my life.
There's a whole generation of people who had the advantage of a free education. Great many of them moved into politics, I think. It was a great kind of training ground. Student politics has always been, of course, a great kind of training ground for politics later in life. Were you much involved in politics at uni?
I was. I was elected chairperson of the Monash Association of Students. That was the pinnacle of my student politics career. And there was this woman called Julia Gillard, who was president of Australian Union of Students at the time. So there was a bit of a batch of us. Some went significantly further than others. there was a strong involvement in campus politics.
And you made a lot of friends within the Labor movement that you still have then?
Yes, quite a deal. Yeah, sometimes you have significant differences, but you got to stay civil in these things.
Of course. Now, you said you joined forces at one stage later on with younger progressives in the party, and you mentioned Lindsay Tanner in particular, who's also done this hour with me on a previous occasion. He's just left politics.
Yes. Well, Lindsay was a little bit older than me, and he was just leaving Melbourne Uni student politics when I was just starting in Monash student politics. And a couple of years later, when I'm still trying to finish my degree amongst all the other things that student life brings, I was working at the TAB at Telephone Betting, which was a very big place at the time, and ran into Lindsay there, and we decided that we'd support his little campaign to try to democratise and bring what was then the Federated Clerks Union into the 20th century. And remarkably, we were successful.
Now, Lindsay and Julia, of course, had a bit of a stoush over the seat of Melbourne, didn't they?
Ah, they did. Yeah, she's got a good memory, Duck.
I've done my research.
I was always a Julia Gillard supporter, even though on that occasion I might have voted the other way.
But these things run deep in the Labor Party. I think
they
people
do.
People don't forget these things, do they?
No, they don't. But hey, it all worked out in the end.
Well, it did. Now, you mentioned the, what did you call it? The Federated Clerks Union?
Yes, yes.
That sounds awfully Dickensian.
Ah,
kind
yes.
It comes up visions of you sitting on a stool with a quill pen.
Yes, yes. And in many ways it was. It was, if you're into your Labor history, it was one of the DLP Catholic grouper controlled unions. It was a former communist run union in the 50s, and the groupers knocked it over in the 50s. And it was highly conservative, highly unrepresentative of its predominantly women members, and highly ineffective. So it failed on a lot of grounds.
Why would anybody be a member?
That's a very good question, because this was another era when you were signed up by the boss.
Right.
And it was a tool of controlling the workforce.
So
we thought this was a very bad idea.
So who were the members? Who were the clerks that were members? I mean, what kind of jobs would they be doing?
Well, this was then the biggest workplace that the union had in Victoria. These were telephone betting operators. So
right.
You'd take a bet. There were over 1,100 of us down there in Queens Road. But it was also airline checking indoor staff, call centres, all sorts of people in basically female-dominated, low-paid, vulnerable positions.
So very basic office work.
It could well be. Overwhelmingly, that sort of work.
Right. And as you say, not very well paid. So how did you set about modernising an organisation like that?
Through essentially just trying to apply some principles of participation that we got elected. We ran on a platform of making sure that we didn't do what the boss said. We did what the members said. We built up the whole notion that they had power in their workplace, the whole notion that we would represent them as themselves, where we made sure that initially we had 50% women, and by the time in all positions, and by the time of two or three elections later, 75%, and now it's, although it's amalgamated into a number of other organisations over time, continues to be run by women, led by women, representing women. And that's a very important lesson, that if you want people to take power, you've got to be representative of that group that you're asking them to exercise power on behalf of.
And you said previously it was effectively a management tool. It belonged to the bosses rather than to the membership.
Absolutely. Under a centralised wage-fixing system where everything was resolved in the then Industrial Arbitration Court, there was very little opportunity for members to have a go.
So it was a kind of like a cosy deal between the union leadership and the managements that they dealt with.
It was.
And they sort of sat down in a smoke-filled room somewhere, as the cliché goes, and just decided what everybody would do.
And you would be told if it was deemed appropriate later.
Yeah, opportunities for corruption too in that sort of setup, in a small way at least, I would have thought.
I would have thought so. I wouldn't want to suggest that there was any, and I never saw any opportunity for it. But what I did see as a rank and file member was just a hopeless organisation, and that was the motivation to.
Wasn't doing anything for the membership.
No.
So you rolled your sleeves up and got stuck in.
We got stuck in.
Not everybody does that, though. I mean, most people sit back and do nothing. Why do you think you decided to put your hand up and, actually do the work?
That's a good question.
Was that more of the Catholic background kicking
possibly,
in there?
I didn't think of that. Yeah, it might well be. There's no point whinging unless you're prepared to have a crack at something, was one of those lessons. And just looking back at my nan's trade union background and her family's background, that's what you did.
Hmm. Because that's not the response that occurs to everybody, is it? Most people kind of shrug their shoulders and go, oh, that's the way it is. Don't rock the boat, all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
Don't make waves. That's what my family were always telling me.
You're a long time dead is what my nan used to always tell me. So you might as well...
Might as well try and make some sort of difference while you're here. Yes. I would go along with that. Now, we were talking about your time at the Clerks Union, and then you went on to the ASU.
Well, the Clerks then amalgamated in a three-way amalgamation into the ASU as part of the union amalgamation process in the early 90s. And at that time, Lindsay then moved on into federal parliament
You were climbing the ladder inside the ASU.
I did indeed.
And you eventually got to be the president.
I did, yes. Secretary, assistant secretary, and secretary, and then president, and they were good times.
Well, that's 15 years in all.
It was, yes.
Now, why then the shift into politics? Because it must be really different in politics to what it is being a union official.
Well, it was an accident. I've just figured it was the Ansett collapse and seeing 16,000 people lose their jobs and the sheer terrible cynicism that the federal government held that company and, more importantly, its workers out on a limb deliberately, that was enough for me, and the trauma that was associated. After having bedded that down, I thought, well, time to go. I'm too bitter and twisted in this job now, and resigned, and unexpectedly got a call from some people asking me, did I want to go and work in government, which I had no intention of doing, but that's where I ended up.
So what was your first job in government?
I was chief of staff to the Minister for Primary Industries, as he then was, and I was there for 3 years, and after which time he was the Minister for Police at the last part of it. So that was Bob Cameron, and they were instructive times for me.
Now, somebody somewhere must have been doing a bit of talent spotting here. They must have thought you'd be good in politics.
Well, I don't know if it exactly works that way. It's kind of... I'd always been active. I'd always been trying to push a barrier of reform, whether it was of the party itself or whether it was of policy. And remarkably, John Thwaites and Steve Brax tapped them out at the same time and an opportunity fell on my head.
That was quite a remarkable thing when they suddenly upped and left. I mean, took everyone by surprise, I think.
Sure did.
Were you expecting that?
No, not at all. Knocked me over with a feather when it happened, that's for sure.
And particularly when John Thwaites went, I think, because there went Steve Brax, and there was a kind of a logic to that. But then John Thwaites almost immediately followed him out the door.
Yes, he did. That was an amazing day, that's for sure. But then when you look back at it with the hindsight now, they were such a team. And John had been there 15 years, you know, done some hard times in opposition as well as that time as Deputy Premier, and was still young enough to have another go at things. And I think from his own point of view, it's been quite a successful decision by him.
Yeah, what's he doing now?
All sorts of things. He heads up the Monash Sustainability Centre or Institute, I forget its name, Climate Works, which is kind of a cross departmental and faculty organisation looking at issues around climate change and sustainability. He volunteers, he's on the board of the Brotherhood of St Lawrence in an honorary capacity. He chairs the Centre for the Moving Image and does, you know, bits and pieces. He's certainly not having
a quiet life.
No,
anyway,
he's very busy.
Well, of course, John Thwaites was very popular with our community, mainly because he was, you know, dropping into his speedos.
That's right.
Every time you turned around, basically, either him or Steve Brax was climbing out of the briny in their speedos. It doesn't seem to have worked for Ted Bailey, but
I assure you, it wouldn't work for me, Doug.
I was going to say,
I want people to vote for me, not against
you.
Me.
You went a slightly different route. Let's put it that way.
Now, genetics predetermines some things, I'm afraid.
But big shoes to fill.
Oh, absolutely, and I couldn't pretend to replicate the efforts that John did in how he essentially helped run the state and turn around the legacy of the Kennett years, let alone his leadership in lots of different areas of good public policy. But what I've tried to do is essentially build on those where I can, particularly in the local community, and make sure that that progressive mantle that he did so much to build up is extended.
What's the constituency work like? I mean, do you see a lot of your constituents?
Yes, I see quite a lot of my constituents. Bless all 47,000 of them. It's a very demanding position, and how you could do that and be Deputy Premier just staggered me. But it's fantastic. This is a community that is dynamic. It's, you know, it's diverse. It prides itself on tolerance, and it is just such a joy to be part of its leadership and representing its interests.
Because one thinks of it as being a fairly wealthy constituency, but you've actually got quite a broad range, haven't you?
It is. You know, you've got to be an AFL footballer to buy in Albert Park, but having said that, we have huge pockets of disadvantage. We have 2,500 public housing units. We have social infrastructure that tracks people when they're down their luck, whether it's Father Bob or Hanover or the Sacred Heart Mission or any number of other agencies. We are truly a diverse community, and making sure it stays that way, which is a bit hard sometimes, is a key part of what I do.
Because that's one of the problems of the more inner city suburbs, isn't it? As property prices have gone up, as land prices have gone up, a lot of people have been squeezed out. and the diversity tends to disappear then. It just becomes another middle-class enclave.
Yes, that's why active interventions such as those organisations I spoke about, the social and community housing investment that we're putting in, needs an active, strong role for government to make sure that what makes the place interesting in the first place is not destroyed, and that we're all not just vanilla versions of something else, but that we have genuine diversity, that we are rich and poor side by side.
How can you help achieve that? I mean, can you insist, for example, on developers providing a certain percentage of social housing?
I would love that power, Doug. It's infinitely more a negotiating process and taking the opportunities where they arise. For instance, Father Bob, who we all love, we've saw an opportunity with him when he ran into his difficulties with the Archbishop, and essentially put together a package which is going to see an old disused building that he's had turned into social housing units. 41 people who would be at risk of homelessness otherwise, secure them in their own community that otherwise they'd be turfed out of, together with securing the future of Father Bob's parish and underwriting all the work that he does. And we've done that in partnership with Southport Community Housing, who are a terrific group, and we are infrastructure, social infrastructure rich in our community, and using the opportunities that are there, building the networks to make sure that you can lock people in secure, affordable homes, not just boxes, but homes that have support, is fundamental to trying to maintain that. Because we get lots of people who say this is a great place to live, but then suddenly find reasons why the very things that made it a great place to live are suddenly not so welcome.
Well, we've seen that in some of the inner city areas where people object to nightclubs and object to noise and all those sort of things, which were there long before they were.
Yeah.
Do you have any famous pubs and things in your bailiwick that cause the odd problem?
Oh, yes, we do. And these things need management. Without doubt, some of the club cultures, particularly through alcohol abuse, got out of hand. But having said that, with appropriate regulation, with appropriate education, with appropriate policing, you can, and we've actually seen in the Fitzroy Street block in St Kilda, we've seen, after it peaked about 18 months ago, a reduction in the violence, a reduction in the alcohol abuse. It's always an issue, but we've just got to make sure that we work through it in a way that maintains the dynamic, interesting nature of the place, but also makes it a good and safe place to live.
Yeah, but not too safe. We're almost at the end of our hour together. Been quite fascinating, all this Labour history we've been getting today. A good old solid dose of real socialism. We don't see much of that in the Labour Party these days.
No.
It's a different beast.
It is, but it's always changed. When you look at the history of the party, it's always looking to how to engage and re-engage. It goes through cycles. It goes through its ups and its downs. Clearly, federally at the moment, it's in a bit of a funny spot, but I'd like to think that its enduring qualities are its ability to renew and to stay on the progressive side of democratic politics.
Because there's been a lot of criticism, particularly during this election and after this election, that somehow Labour's kind of lost its way, it's lost its soul, it's only interested in winning votes, it's not really interested in putting up policies on a basis of any kind of belief.
And clearly the federal election just gone would do nothing but confirm that view, Doug. But that does not reflect the party's culture, it does not reflect the party's membership. And when Labour is successful, it is not that. When Labour is successful, it is the party of ideas, the party of vision, and the party of engagement with both its traditional working families or blue-collar organisations, and more broadly, those who look to Labour and government to make your life less miserable, together with those who look to Labour as the vehicle to tackle the big social issues of the day, the big issues of what kind of a society are we. You meld those two, and that's a precondition for success. It's not a guarantee of success, but it's a precondition for success. And somehow or another, the geniuses who ran the last federal election campaign lost sight of that fundamental truth.
because a lot of the criticism of that campaign was basically saying those two things were not, in fact, compatible. That they, to borrow the pejorative term that the Australian might use, for example, the sort of latte-sipping set in the inner cities are pulling in one direction, and the working class base, as it were, is pulling in another, completely different direction, and that Labor can no longer straddle that divide.
And people who say that generally have a philosophy that they wish to push you in the party in the direction of being a conservative kowtower to their interests. The Labor strategy of success is building a national narrative that properly binds those two constituencies and other constituencies together. You don't have to go back too far to see how successful that can and has been. Rudd did it in 2007, the taking action on climate change at Kyoto at the same time as building together the anti-work choices campaign. Keating did it in the unwinnable 93 election. The broad vision of our place as an independent nation in Asia, cutting its own way whilst looking after those who needed an active government. Gough did it. He was the first to really do it after so long in the wilderness. Yes, it has to change. Yes, it has to be modernised in the current context. But people who take the view that the Labor Party should somehow or another just be better managers than the other mob miss the fundamental question that Labor is about building a better, fairer and more sustainable society. And you can't do that just through managerialism.
Victoria actually did better than anywhere else for the Labor Party in this election. And Victoria's been... I think is still probably the most successful state, is it not?
Yes, in terms of its primary vote. I think Tasmania might have got a higher primary vote.
But, I'm thinking in terms, in more general terms than just the vote, but I mean as a functioning entity. I mean, within WA, obviously, you've got boom and bust because of the mining thing.
Yes.
But on a steady state kind of basis, Victoria seems to run pretty well with Labor.
Oh, look, we've got a lot of challenges, without doubt, and no one would underestimate the challenges of either winning the upcoming state election or the policy challenges of whoever's in government afterwards. But what this state Labor government has done is just hasn't looked at managerialism and a sensible, prudent running of the economy, which it's done, as an end in itself. It's looked at that as that creates the opportunities and the fruits that you can then distribute, that you can then invest, that you can then pursue a better and fairer Victoria. And one of the things that certainly John Thwaites, my predecessor in the seat of Albert Park, was fundamental in putting together was the whole Fairer Victoria strategy, which is a first for Australia, which makes every department, every decision of cabinet, every program of government linked into how it can go about building, contributing to a better and fairer Victoria. And that strategy, it's gone through several iterations, has been, I think, one of the defining features of this government, together with its commitment to wanting to make sure that it continues to be in a position to do so by running a effective economic ship.
One of the things that hasn't run terribly effectively, and I have to bring it up, is public transport.
Yes.
Now, I know that you were left with a bit of a dog's breakfast of a situation after the privatisation and so on and so forth. My personal thought was, I don't know why you didn't take it back into public ownership. Especially when some of the contractors were quite willing to walk away.
Well, indeed, National Trains threw the keys back because the contract was so difficult for them in terms of trying to meet its obligations of the then Kennett contracts. But they were renegotiated and a new operator came in. That new operator then fell over and we got another new operator. Simply the enormous cost in buying back those privatised arrangements is enormous and would hinder us from doing much else.
But aren't you spending an awful lot of money to keep them going?
Absolutely. And even more importantly, we're spending now, in the last two budgets, the majority of transport and infrastructure spending has been on public transport infrastructure. The truth of the matter is that there is substantial ground to be made up, but what we're looking at is a generational shift in how that infrastructure is going to be applied, whether it's the country rail links, whether it's the new train rolling stock or the 50 new trams. All of these arrangements are firstly incredibly expensive, but secondly time-consuming in terms of how put public transport down. So, and whether it's the South Morang Rail Link and all these kind of things that are now happening, clearly there's issues around timing and how, after a generation of totally focusing on ever-expanding urban boundaries and roads, we are now seeing that consolidation.
Yeah.
Perhaps we can do a bit more, but I'd like to think that the budgets of following where the commitment, following where the dollars are going, reflects that generational change in public transport infrastructure.
Yeah, because you can't keep building roads and you can't keep pumping more cars into what is a finite space.
Exactly right. And that needs us all as a community to look at what increased medium density living and society means. And
that must be a hard one to juggle in a constituency like yours, where you've got all these wealthy people with their houses they paid a small fortune for, and they do not wish to be overlooked by a town block.
Yes, that's a very good way of putting it. But at the same time, St Kilda is one of the most densely populated parts of Victoria, and Port Melbourne is rapidly following. So there is generally, I like to think, of, particularly in the under 35s, there's a general willingness that says, this is the kind of place I want to be, this is the kind of infrastructure that we live in, and that means certain compromises. And you're seeing that happen. And actually, it means better services, better delivery, because you're in a better position to be able to pay for it.
You wrote at the end of the notes that you gave me that you're a true believer.
Yes.
Not in the Catholic Church, but in the Labour Party. Have you just swapped the one for the other?
Yes, I had several people suggest that to me over the years.
Well, they always say there's no one more enthusiastic than a convert.
Yes. I don't want to wait around to the next life to see a better life. I want to make sure that the fruits of justice and the ability to make life better is not sitting up on a harp. It's sitting around in this community, making this community a better one. And
you see yourself staying in politics for the foreseeable?
Well, I'm standing again at this election, and these are uncertain times, Doug, so I wouldn't like to make a prediction.
Well, if the voters will have you.
If the voters will have me, I will certainly be in parliamentary politics, but I think I will always be in some form of politics.
Yeah, you've got no particular hankering like Lindsay to go off and live on a farm and put it all behind you yet.
No. Too many challenges.
Well, Martin, thank you very much for joining us today. We've got one more piece of music to go out on. The Chieftains, The Wind from the South. It's also something unpronounceable in Gaelic, but we won't try that. Now, that's very different to your other music choices. This harks back to Irish roots.
Yes, yes. The Foleys come from County Cork, a town called Glandore, and I did see the Chieftains many, many years ago in Ireland, and my dad was a great fan of the Chieftains, and this is a song we played at his funeral, so it's always been important to me.
Okay, well, Martin, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Doug. I very much enjoyed it.
And this is the Chieftains, The Wind from the South.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.